access number 28660, Captain Robert Bonner, Reel 7.
And where they could take their German girlfriends, or meet their German girlfriends, and no problem at all in fraternizing. That word was never used because it was just a normal situation.
Did you attempt to learn German yourself, or was it encouraged that people learn German?
It very much encouraged to learn German. I myself, I'd learnt German a little bit at school and a lot in at Sandhurst, and because of this, and I was still fairly fluent in those days, I was able to probably make myself known and understood rather more easily than quite a lot of people. In addition to this, we had wonderful opportunities for sport in those days, and
tell me about the sporting activities, because I mean the British Army in the Rhine is well known for that. What was available?
We had the good fortune of having the pre-war German Olympic Stadium right in the midst of the British sector. I was the battalion athletics officer in those days.
What did that involve?
That involved looking after and selecting and training the athletic teams, the competitive athletic teams for athletics stand for cross country, and also any general athletics, sort of the annual sports days and general cross country runs and things like that. Really, sort of everything based on long distance running. Having the Olympic sports sprouts right in our midst was just a most wonderful opportunity. And in those days, we trained hard in barracks or elsewhere until midday, had our midday meal, and then all those able, not on other duties, moved in transport from Spandau up to the Charlottenburg to the Olympic Stadium, where we were able to get on and do our own thing. So as far as I was concerned, it was training people on the Olympic tracks, and for others into the gymnasiums, football pitches, hockey pitches. No excuse for any soldier in that battalion not being able to exercise and enjoy some form of physical exercise and sport virtually every day of the week. And then after that was, after a sort of a hot afternoon at that, into the Olympic swimming pools, and also the luxury steam baths and a host of wonderful German professional therapists, massage, nothing better than after a good afternoon's running or swimming or whatever to be able to relax and be pummeled by a sort of a great 20 stone German pugilist. So that was the average officers and soldiers' day.
What about other recreations? You know, what as you're an officer, what was it, or all the men? What was there for them to do in the more normal recreational way?
Well, the men had they had a very fine NAFI canteen within the barracks. They could, if they wished, as could anybody in the regiment. And they had a mind to learn how to ride, and with the horses which we already had in the barracks, and there were other opportunities to visit other regiments and organise other Royal Army Service Corps people and others, the Royal Air Force, in and around Berlin. In addition, as far as the officer was concerned, the Berlin Control Commission, which was British officers of the British police or ex-army and ex-navy and air force people who were helping to run the civil administration in the west, in the British sector of Berlin, they gave quite a lot of parties of one form or another, to which there was always an invitation for four or five officers to attend. So I suppose And similar invitations came from the French and the Americans.
What about culturally? I mean, I know Berlin was in a mess, but I mean, was there things like theatre, opera, or anything like that? Or was that
it was a for culture-starved Britishers, Berlin was magnificent. The opera houses were back in full swing, and it didn't matter whether they were, because bear in mind that the wall had not got up, but not been put up by the Russians, so we had full access through the Brandenburg Gate into East Berlin. Couldn't go into East Germany officially, but go into East Berlin, provided you were in uniform. So we had access night after night, if necessary, to the most wonderful opera in the east of Berlin, and in the west, the Stadttheater and the Open Haus, and those were, you know, truly magnificent and not expensive, so that those of us who were culturally minded got a real education in classical opera.
Now, how did you get on with the Soviets and the East Germans that you encountered? What was the relation? I don't know whether it's the Soviets you'd encounter or the East Germans at that stage.
Well, at that stage, the East Germans were not supposed to exist as a form of authority. It happened shortly afterwards. So we were not allowed to have anything to do with anyone who was supposedly an East German in authority. So we had to dealt with the Russians and the Americans and the French.
How did you get on with one by one, the Soviets?
Well, it all comes back really to another of the roles of our being in Berlin was looking after the war criminals in Spandau Prison. And at that time, Hess was there, of course, and Speer, and I suppose about another six or seven of those who've been found guilty at Nuremberg. And
now, what was your role concerning Spandau?
Spandau Prison was based on the prison itself was run by a conglomerate of Russians, French, American, and British wardens. Under four separate prison commandants, entirely multiracial, multicultural. They were the basic hardcore unit who ran the administration of the prison and were responsible for the prisoners and their well-being. But to guard them, each of the four nations, the Russians, the French, the Americans, ourselves, provided a guard which lasted, if I remember rightly, for a week at a time. It was really, in many ways, considered rather unnecessary, but it was so the Russians, for example, would take over the guard duties. They would hand over at a ceremonial parade after a week and hand over to the French, who would then in turn hand over to the Americans, who would then turn over to ourselves, and we then would hand over 5 weeks later to the Russians. It was always felt that the real reason behind this installation of an international guard was the fact that the Russians themselves had no reason to come into West Berlin, into the British sector, without having cause. And the only reason they could find cause was to actually come to Spandau Prison, and there they would be in relative force, and they could then travel in and out of the British sector with impunity. In the same way, there was a Russian war memorial just inside the British sector, a couple of hundred yards away from the Brandenburg Gate, where the Russians were allowed to maintain a guard and also allow that guard to be changed every day. So there were two opportunities here for the Russian army to come in and out of West Berlin with fairly reasonably free access.
What would happen when you were on guard, your battalion? Or would your support company not do it? I mean,
you're quite right, actually. The The guard duties were carried out by the by platoons from the infantry companies, and they would after be highly prepared for this very public display of the regiment's ability, and so selected soldiers form the platoon guard, all beautifully polished and blancoed, and be inspected on the parade ground by the adjutant, and then they would march from the barracks the fairly short distance to Spandau Prison, where the changing of the guard would take over. And then inside, the men would take over the guard duties on the main gates and on the various towers, and otherwise just settle in carrying out normal guard duties as they would, in fact, in an ordinary infantry barracks. There was no, although they would see the prisoners, there was no direct contact between the guard, members of the guard, or the criminal, war criminals themselves. But it was a very interesting experience for everybody involved.
Now, how did you get on with the French and American authorities? Was there any friction or trouble, or was that perfectly amicable?
I'm just going to go and have a glass of water.
You want to mention the East German?
Yeah. At that stage in sort of international arrangements in Germany, the East Germans were in the process of forming a people's police, the Volkspolizei, and they were not then uniformed other than wearing a sort of dirty dark green pair of overalls, and we had strict instructions not to take any notice of them at all. But there was one particular occasion which ought to be recorded, and that is when, as I mentioned earlier, we had this nice little stable of horses, and one Saturday afternoon, Captain Robert Clutterbuck, the adjutant, and Lieutenant Wilkie decided to go for a pleasant country ramble on horseback, and taking the German groom who looked after the horses with them. So the three of them set off, and to the south of Spandau, which into the open country, which was reached very quickly. But it was, of course, fairly sensitive country, because the border between East Germany, as opposed to East Berlin, ran up to the border in Spandau. And after they had been going for some while, enjoying a pleasant ride, they were on an open country road with a ditch on one side, and suddenly out of the ditch jumped about a dozen or so of these German Volkspolizei in their overalls, all carrying rifles, and indicated to Robert Clutterbuck that he and his little party should halt. And Robert, being a fine, dignified British Army officer, told them what to do and to go away. So that, and he and Ted Wilkie rode on, and when suddenly they heard the noise of rifle bolts being brought into action, and at that stage Robert decided that discretion was the inevitable better part of valor. So that took place, which of course we knew nothing at all about, because this was well away from the barracks, until several hours later, when we heard through the control commission in its headquarters in Berlin that the Russian army had got hold of two officers of the Manchester Regiment and the German groom. And there were then difficulties of negotiation. So negotiations took place over the Saturday night, and Robert and Ted were kept with the German groom, kept in close confines overnight. And then it was only later on the Sunday, when a great cheer arose from the entrance to the barracks, when Robert Clutterbuck, Ted Wilkie, and the groom were seen walking their horses through the main gate into barracks, having caused their own little international incident, but there were no repercussions, so all was well. But it was the first occasion when we actually did come into close quarters with the
And you had no trouble with the American or French authorities, obviously?
No, we there was a lot of liaison, I think particularly in the sergeant's mess between the Americans and ourselves. The French not to the same extent, although we were invited and went to some of their parties, which were always very extravagant and enjoyable. And I do remember one particular parade being held on Gatow, which was the airport in the French sector, when the French commandant was returning to France, and we were asked to provide a guard of honour with the Americans and the French to celebrate his departure. So we rolled up and did our bit on the parade ground, and I shall never forget this General Lacheur, or what, I can't remember, I think it was Lacheur, as he inspected the ranks, coming up and standing in front of me and saying, "Vraiment, c'est magnifique," and then dashing off to get into his aeroplane. We then had an excellent lunch, and that was the end of that particular occasion. But it was a very pleasant opportunity of meeting and socialising with the French.
And what about unless there's anything else about Berlin, what about the preparations for leaving? Because you were only there another year, weren't you?
That's right, it was a year. Berlin was a posting for a year for all battalions, and time came for us to get prepared to go on elsewhere. At that time, there were two major theatres of war elsewhere in the world. One was Korea, which had broken out earlier, and the other was Malaya. So it was really touch and go as to which area we would go to. None of us particularly liked the idea of Korea, and a lot of people, particularly some of our senior officers and senior non-commissioned officers who had been captured at the fall of Singapore and held prisoner by the Japanese in most dreadful circumstances during the war, they very understandably were very reluctant to even consider having to go back to the Far East. It held such unpleasant memories for so many of them. In the event, we were told it would be Malaya, and so our sets were set on that, and we left Berlin in...
How do you prepare to leave? Was there a sort of major handover or any preparations before you left?
Well, there's the normal frantic preparations by the quartermaster and the quartermaster sergeants throughout the battalion in making sure that everything in the barracks is left as spick and span as possible, with as few damages as possible, so that at the end of the day, when the marching in comes of the replacement battalion, the exiting battalion is not left with too much to pay in the way of barrack damages. So there's a lot of good housekeeping goes on at that particular time, but nothing of great excitement on the move. Everybody, an advance party was selected and moved back to England, to Chester. About
this is in, the generally you left in April 51 to go back to Dale Barracks?
We went to the Dale in Chester, yes. The advance party had already gone and is taken over the barracks, and the main body of the battalion moved by train and boat back to the UK.
Now, what was the setup there when you got to the Dale Barracks?
The Dale was traditionally a barracks used by the Cheshire Regiment on the outskirts of Chester, and it had just trying to think what it was. It was and was a typical wartime establishment of wooden huts for all ranks. One old Edwardian or Victorian building being used as the officers' mess, but to the best of my recollection, that was the only permanent building on the camp. Everything else was certainly in the typical wooden hut, which had been which everyone found in all camps of that sort throughout the country. So we didn't have much time to spend there. We took in a lot of new recruits, mainly national servicemen.
How did national servicemen fit in? You were now a regular battalion. How was the process of managing the takeover? Taking them in managed.
It was a very interesting period and a very interesting experience dealing with the sort of fitting in of all these young national servicemen. Understandably, the majority were there rather against their will at the time. They'd all gone through a period of training, basic training at one of the infantry depots, and they came to us as trained soldiers after, I suppose, eight week soldiering. One of the great advantages of the chaps that we got at that time was that they were all from the Greater Manchester. Many of them had been at the same schools. They lived in the same areas. They all knew each other. And this, in fact, made life much easier from the regiment's point of view in absorbing them into the system. And I was astonished at how quickly they, because we had not only we had lost quite a lot of our own long-term regular soldiers to the King's Liverpool Regiment, who had gone off just ahead of us to fight in Korea. So we were understandably short of a lot of experienced soldiers. But it was remarkable how quickly these young men, these young national servicemen, settled in, and how quickly they became part of the Manchesters.
How was their sort of quality of training and quality of personnel as compared to, say, the regular drafts that you were getting? I mean, were they as well trained? Were they as good material?
Oh, the material was of a very high standard. It would be difficult to make a comparison, one a regular against a national serviceman, because many of the national servicemen that we were getting at that time decided that for the dubious privilege of signing off for an extra 6 months, they could become regular soldiers on a three-year engagement and earn a higher rate of pay from the day they signed on. So it's difficult to make a comparison. Suffice to say that they fitted in very well. Because they had so many of them in this particular situation had known each other from earlier days, they all rapidly became little units on their own. And the remarkable thing is that now, 50-odd years later, they are all, or so many of them, are still enthusiastic, vital members of the Regimental Association. And I think that in itself speaks wonderful tales.
You also got a new colonel. Colonel
Woolsey.
It's Tommy. What's it?
Tommy.
Is that what you all called him?
Yes.
He's EF, but that wasn't used.
No, Tommy. Yes.
Tommy Woolsey. Now, what was he like? You'd had a very good, this disciplinarian but very efficient Colonel Frampton. And what was Woolsey like?
Hey-ho. Colonel Tommy Woolsey joined us at this stage, having taken over from George Frampton, and then taken over, as General Keitner has said, a highly efficient and happy battalion. Tommy was a different character altogether. He had commanded the 7th Manchesters for a period during the Second World War, and he was a very fine, outgoing, Difficult. That's what I mean. Stop.
And I can sense you finding this difficult. I mean, to look at it another way, was he as competent, say, as Frampton had been?
Tommy was an entirely different type of soldier. He had a very fine war record, and post-war he had spent quite a long time in Malaya as chief instructor at the jungle training school in the south of Malaya. So, in theory, he was going to be the ideal commanding officer for a battalion going into action against communist guerrillas in Malaya. He was a most delightful man and well-liked and respected by all ranks. But somehow those particular qualities which we had enjoyed from his predecessor didn't come through quite to the same effect. And although he went on to command for through our period, or most of our period in Malaya, we did feel that under a stronger commanding officer, we would probably have achieved a lot more than we eventually did.
I think that's enough to give us the idea. Now, the only other thing is that you took advantage of your freedom in the city. Now, that's quite unusual that for battalions to actually get the chance to do that.
That's right.
It doesn't happen that often, does it? Well, do you remember anything about that? Were you on that march?
I was carrying the colours.
He said they can't
say. No, you can't say. That's me there.
So what was it like to take...
We were... Whilst we were in Chester, during our short stay in Chester, we had the opportunity of exercising our freedom of the city of Manchester to march through the city with bayonets fixed, colours flying, and drums beating. This was particularly relevant as well to the regiment because the Lord Mayor of Manchester at that time was himself an ex-officer of the regiment. He had fought in the First World War with the 16th Battalion at the Battle of Manchester Hill, and he had then joined the Ardwick Battalion and became their colonel and eventually their honorary colonel. So it was rather nice that we were able to pay our respects not only to the city but also to a distinguished and famous soldier of the regiment. So you can imagine that much time was spent in really just basic drills, getting all these new recruits together, learning how to march, how to get a bit of swagger into their steps, and also, of course, get their uniforms and their boots polished up and smartened up to the standards which were required before they went on public display. And when the day came, it was...
That's the 11th of May, 51. I'm just reading the book.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
How did it go?
At the time, I was...
Lieutenant.
No. Yes. At the time, because one or two of the more senior subalterns had already gone out to Malaya in the advance party, I was the senior subaltern at the time, so I had the privilege of carrying the Queen's colour on the parade. So which in itself was a great honour, and we went by train into Manchester, assembled near London Rail Station, and then marched right down Market Street, Mosley Street, Deansgate, and on to get it right.